All right, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning service, coming to you live from the historic Temple Sinai Synagogue in St. Francisville. Thanks to an arrangement with the Julius Freehand Foundation and the West Feliciana Historical Society. Thank you for being here with us today. I'm pleased to be here. I did want to start off this morning by passing along a couple of prayer requests. Most of you might know this already, but Timothy Thompson, a longtime friend and member of United Israel World Union, one of our officers, in fact, is asked for prayer. His mom, Geraldine, had a stroke Monday, and she's in hospice now, and he's really just asked for prayer. You know, it's a very tough time when our loved ones reach that place, and so lift up Timothy, his family, and his mom during this difficult time. And then the other prayer request is for 21-year-old Yael Good. We haven't had an update because of Shabbat, but it's a very dire situation. And so she is in a hospital in Texas. The family has asked for prayer. So keep those two families in your prayers this morning. All right, so Shabbat Shalom. Welcome. My message this morning is based on the final reading, the final Torah reading in the book of Genesis. It is called Vayihi. Vayihi. It's the final portion of Genesis, and therefore, in some ways, you could call it the end of the beginning. The book of beginnings. Genesis is called in Hebrew Bereshi, the book of beginnings, and it covers from the creation of the cosmos. It begins Bereshi bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz, and in beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the story goes through historical narratives and brings us to the closing passage and the word that's used at the end of the book of Genesis is Egypt. It's in Egypt. So from the creation until the stage is set, if you will, everything from the creation until the end of the book of Genesis seems to be, in a way, leading to the great stage of Egypt, the great stage upon which Jehovah will make a name for himself. So it's almost like everything brings us to this point. And by the end of today's reading, by the end of Vayihi, Joseph and Jacob, two of the key figures in the Genesis narrative, are dead. The Haftarah, the prophet reading that is associated with the Torah portion, Vayihi, comes to us from 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. And in that Haftarah, it's the story of the death of Israel's celebrated psalmist king, David. Now, one might be inclined, if you look at the underlying theme of the Torah portion and the prophet reading that's associated therewith, to focus on death. I mean, we have these key figures, the towering figures of Jacob, also known as Israel, and Joseph, his favored son, the death of David in the prophet reading. But interestingly enough, the Torah portion that contains the death of these towering figures and is associated with the prophet reading that talks about the death, that describes the scene of the final moments of David's life, interestingly enough, The Torah portion is known as Vayihi, which means, and he lived. And he lived. Death is, as David puts it, the way of all the earth. Now, I like that image. You know, the Hebrew Bible is fairly consistent in its description of that final part of our life. But it is a part of our life. And I think that that's what's so important to bring out. Death comes to all. But I want to focus today on life. Just as the Torah portion and the prophet section speak of death, I want to go with, according to the theme, if you will, taking my cue from the title of the portion and the first words of the Torah portion in Genesis chapter 47, verse 28, Vayihi, I want to focus on life. But I want to draw in certain things, and I've titled my teaching today, Providence and the Preservation of Life. Providence and the preservation of life. Now, providence is not a word that you'll find in the text of the Bible. But you will find examples over and over and over of providence. And so I want to pick up on some of that today. Jacob was 147 years old when he died. He described his life, his lengthy life, to Pharaoh in the following words. Go to Genesis 47. Genesis chapter 47, beginning in verse 7. 47:7. And Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how old are you? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojournings are 130 years. At the time, he was 130. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they've not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojournings. When Jacob looks back over at the time, 130 years of life, he describes these days as few and bad. Now, we have a glimpse into Jacob's life, and we can recognize the things which take place in his life, which he would categorically describe as few and bad, can't we? We can look at those things. But we're going to look at another aspect of Jacob's life, one that he also admits, and that's going to be the basis for the teaching today on the providence and the preservation of life. The story also contains, throughout the narratives that we read in today's Torah portion, blessings in various manners. Here we just read that Jacob blessed Pharaoh. We also read in the story today that the aged patriarch, Jacob, Israel, blesses Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and he also blesses his own children who become the progenitors of the nation of Israel. So in chapter 48 of Genesis, in the Torah portion, we read a series of blessings where he speaks to his sons. And this is quite interesting. Now, I'll say that only after Jacob passes along these blessings, these final poetic, and I might even say prophetic blessings. Only afterwards does Jacob die. So he's able to pass along certain key information, not only to his sons, but extending far into the future. And how do we know this? He says, interestingly enough, when he calls them together, it says that he says, assemble yourselves, gather yourselves, two different Hebrew words, that I might tell you what shall befall you in the latter days. Ba'akarit hayamim, in the latter days. And so Bible students, lovers of Scripture, people who seek to derive information from these texts will often look at these poetic and prophetic words and seek to identify certain traits and tendencies that are conveyed in the words of Jacob to his sons. And that's quite a worthy study. We've done that. I've talked about that. I've taught on that quite often. It's interesting to note that of the sons, when he gives the blessing, only Reuven, Judah, and Joseph are addressed directly. The others are spoken of as if they're not around the bed, like third person. And this one will do this, and he will do that, and he will do that. But when it comes to Judah and Joseph and even Reuven, it's you. It's directly addressed to them. Now, what does that mean? Could they have been the ones closest in proximity to the bed? The aged patriarch is within right there. Maybe. I don't know. But this idea of telling the boys, gather yourselves, assemble yourselves together, and I will tell you what will befall of you in the latter days, indicates sort of a prophetic glimpse. Now, beyond any attempt to interpret these prophetic blessings are some key points in this Torah portion relevant to life, and not just biblical story life, but it sort of brings out, or what I want to bring out from the stories is something that I believe is relevant into our present day. In a more general way, what I want to focus on are things that can be applicable to all. Now, despite Jacob's, let's say, somber reflection of life as he conveys that to Pharaoh, Jacob admits and relates that his life was clearly guided. Throughout the story, we get Jacob in the blessings both to the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, and to his sons, he indicates that things have been guided. One cannot read the story of Jacob from the time that we first meet him until the closing of his eyes in his death. One cannot read that and miss the point that his life is being guided, if you will, by an unseen hand. As we think back through his life, you can come up with plenty of examples on your own. But everything about Jacob's life, even before he's born, in his mother's womb, his mother is told that he has been singled out. Remember the passage that the younger will basically be served by the older. His brother is born first, but he's grabbing the heel. So we get this idea, and it becomes part of the story that Jacob is a fighter. Later in life, we read that he struggles with a malach. He fights, if you will, with an angel. So Jacob, his whole life is charted for him almost. It doesn't mean that every detail of his life is directly pushed into fruition. In other words, some things Jacob does on his own. This isn't to say that he's a puppet or that he goes through life and can only do that which is ordained. I'm not talking about that, but I am bringing up that key events, things behind the scenes, guarantee that the plan and purpose of God through Jacob are realized. Jacob admits this and relates that his life was clearly guided. He had indeed suffered some tough situations. He had suffered the pain of life. He suffered the betrayal. You remember when his son goes up to one of his wives and sleeps with her. He suffers that betrayal. He suffers great loss. We know in the story that Jacob had lived most of his days thinking that his favored son was dead. Turns out he wasn't, but he had to deal with that pain for much of his life. He had to deal with the fact that two of his sons, Simeon and Levi, remember when they move, the boys go out, the situation with Hamor, and they create this scenario where they tell the people of the town, if you're circumcised, we'll marry in with you. Our people will marry your people. And what was that? And what happens is, these people in the story comply, and then Simeon and Levi come in when they're still sore and kill the entire group. So in his eyes, Simeon and Levi had demonstrated great cruelty and created a very difficult situation for him. These are just a few of the things in Jacob's life which one might call few and bad. Few and bad. Remember, his favored wife, Rachel, dies in childbirth on the way to Beit Lechem towards Ephrat. The story is very clear that Rachel is his favorite. She dies in childbirth. And yet, to Joseph and his son, Jacob relates how God had spoken with him and how God had given him a vision of things to come, a vision of a greatness that would soon come about. He describes this in various ways. And one of the things that he says as he relates the story to his sons, when he's blessing the sons of Joseph, one of the things that he says is he refers to the God that shepherded him all of his days. So in Genesis 48, he's talking about how God has led him like a shepherd. This image is consistently used throughout Scripture of God as a shepherd. He refers in the same blessing to Joseph's sons about the Malach who had redeemed him from all bad. These guiding moments in his life, if you will, the vision, the dream. Remember in Genesis 28, Jacob, fleeing from his brother Esau, has a dream. In Torah portion Vayetze, it says that he rests his head upon a stone and he goes to sleep. And in the dream, God comes to him and he sees in this dream a ladder which reached from earth to heaven, and messengers were ascending and descending. He sees this vision, and he hears the words that make promises of a great use for his people, of his descendants, and how ultimately they would be scattered about, spread about for the north, the south, the east, and the west, but that he would be brought back to the land. He gets the patriarchal plan passed to him. And this vision, the dreams, the incidents where God comes to him in these rarest of moments, in the darkest of hours in his life, or what propel him forward. It's these encounters with the divine that take Jacob through the darkest times, those few and bad days, as he describes his life. You know, I was thinking yesterday as I was preparing some notes, and in the distance, I had music playing lightly. And some of you might know this song. People have different taste in music, and some people can see the connection. But James Taylor's song was on, Fire and Rain. You know this song? I've seen fire and I've seen rain. And as I listen to the song, and it goes on to talk about, I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I couldn't find a friend. And so often I think that this description fits the somber reflection that Jacob gives of his own days. But an underlying point, beyond the darkness, beyond the bad, there is this underlying point that the narrative conveys, that there is a providential guidance orchestrated in heaven that concerns the life and times of Jacob. And it goes not just for Jacob. If we go back in biblical narrative before Jacob, we look at Noah. We look at Abraham. You know, as you work your way through, the biblical writer is showing us that God is orchestrating the outcome throughout the text. If he were not orchestrating it, things would not turn out the way they do. We're constantly met with obstacles, if you will, to the fulfillment of the plan. Abraham is to have children such that the stars of heaven, if they could be counted, so could we count Abraham's descendants. But his wife is barren. I mean, how is it going to happen? And then we get to the story of Isaac and Rebekah. Over and over, we get to the story of Jacob, and Rachel is barren. It's only through God's intervention in the affairs of his people that the plan comes to fruition. The key events. Notice I said the key events. Not every single event in the life of these people, but at the right time, at the right instance, in the right circumstance, it seems that the Creator of heaven and earth will intervene to ensure that his plan and purpose will come to fruition. That the key events are guided by the good hand of El Shaddai, which, by the way, is the name that God was known by. Exodus chapter 6, verse 2 tells us that when Jehovah reveals himself to Moses and provides the name, he says, but by this name I was not known to them. I was known as El Shaddai. Now, key point before I get into this, This does not mean that bad does not happen. In other words, the fact that God is guiding the affairs of his people and intervening at key and strategic points along the way, this does not mean that few and bad things will not take place, as we can see from the narrative. It doesn't indicate that there will not be troublesome times, but rather that despite the bad, despite the evil that comes to people's lives, the plans and purposes of God Almighty will ultimately prove true. So I want to look a little bit this morning at some of these points that indicate an awareness on the part of Jacob in particular, and Joseph as well, that God is guiding, that God controls the outcome. Look with me at Genesis chapter 30 and verse 2. I mentioned a moment ago about Rachel being barren. And she is upset, as you can imagine. And she goes to Jacob. And in Genesis chapter 30 and verse 2, it says the following. But let's look at verse 1. And when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said, "Give me children or else I die." And Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from thee the fruit of the womb?" His point being, that's not my place. That's God's place. God is orchestrating this. God is in control of such things. That is outside of what I am able to bring. There are two basic views. There are really a lot of views, but there are two basic views when we talk about the guiding hand of God in the affairs of his people. There's one view that God's hand is in all. That everything, every event is being orchestrated by heaven. There's another view that God's hand is in nothing. But perhaps God's hand is in those key events, guiding his plan and purposes as he chooses, as he wills, and as is needed to bring about the fulfillment of the plan. Jacob says, "Am I in place of God?" In Hebrew, that's Hatachat Elohim. Hatachat Elohim. Anoki or Ani. And the idea is exactly as it says. There is a place for God in bringing about certain things, and there is a place that we fit in. What Jacob's point is that I can't do God's work, and God won't do mine. It's the way I view it. Now, it's only used one other time in Scripture, this phrase, Hatachat Elohim. Hatachat Elohim. Go with me to Genesis chapter 50. And this is towards the end of Genesis. It's also the end of our final reading in Genesis chapter 50. This is after the death of Jacob. Now, the brothers are rightly concerned. Now that the father is gone, their concern is that Joseph will seek revenge, because remember, they did him wrong. They know it, he knows it, and they know he knows it. And the father is no longer there. So the story builds up the tension. You can imagine the boys are talking to one another, and they said, "You know, now that Dad's gone," I'm obviously paraphrasing, just trying to think about the way it might have went down. And so they approach Joseph. Verse 18. His brothers even went and fell down before his face, and they said, "Behold, we're your servants." And Joseph said to them, "Fear not, for am I in the place of God?" Now this is our phrase that I'm talking about. Hatachat Elohim ani. Am I in the place of God? "But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it to pass at this day that much people should be saved alive." Joseph, in his response, is referring to the providence of God, while recognizing that they had done him wrong. He also realizes that all of what took place worked out the way it was supposed to. Hatachat Elohim. Interestingly enough, Rachel is told that by Jacob. And then Rachel's son, her firstborn son, uses the same phrase to the brothers. The answer, I think, is quite instructive. Joseph's point, he says, "You meant evil." He doesn't sugarcoat it. He doesn't dismiss it like, "I know you didn't mean to do this." He says very clearly, "You meant bad against me." That's a fact. We shouldn't ignore the facts on the ground. But again, he recognizes, reports, and relates to them that it was all part of the plan. He now realizes it's part of the plan. Notice what he says the plan is. He says, "To do as this day, to bring life, or to preserve life, or to cause life for Amrav, many people." Now we know from the story that because of this famine, that the children of Israel were saved because of Joseph's placement. But it was also many other people. Joseph's point, again, while recognizing the bad that was committed against him, he makes the point that he's not in God's place, that he's not going to seek vengeance, and this would later be incorporated, I think, into the Torah, this idea. Look with me at Leviticus 19. I think a lot of people consider Leviticus 19:18 to be one of the greatest Torah principles, and yet they don't always quote the entire thing. Today, let's look at it. Everyone knows, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," right? A lot of times you'll see people quote Leviticus 19:18, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Look how it starts. "You shall not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of your people. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." There's a little bit of context there, right? Don't bear a grudge. Don't avenge. But love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, loving your neighbor as yourself can be a very broad point. But in particular, no one wants someone to hold a grudge against them or to seek vengeance. It's really this idea, allow God to be God. I think people need to consider the fullness of that verse. God turned the bad intentions of the brothers into something good. How much of their plan or their devise was being put into their minds by God? I don't know. Remember, the initial point was, let's kill him. Here comes this dreamer, let's kill him. But then it was said, let's not kill him. Let's just put him in a pit. Remember, and then he's sold off. So these ideas ultimately, if you don't have this scenario, you don't get Joseph to Egypt. You don't get Joseph to Egypt. Joseph doesn't rise through the ranks and go from rags to riches to rags to riches and ultimately end up in a place where life is brought about by working through Joseph. You don't have any of that. It takes the bad. How do you get Joseph to Egypt? Well, he has to get to Egypt, so here's what we're going to... The whole plan, it's like when you back up and look at it, you can see how everything worked together. But I promise you that when Joseph was in the midst of that trouble, he couldn't see the goodness and the guiding of God's hand at that point. When he was pulled up out of the pit, can you imagine how betrayed he felt? As he was sold into slavery, he had been robbed of the robe that his father had given him. Can you imagine? He could not have seen that all of this would work out. I think a lot of times when we see someone who's going through a difficult time, we want to be somewhat comforting and we'll say, it's going to be okay. How many of you know you can't always see that okay? I think that a lot of times we want to do the right thing and we want to encourage people to make it through the tough times, but just like Joseph couldn't see him, we can't either. It's only when we can catch our breath again. It's only when we can realize, looking back, that it worked out. It's difficult to see it on the front end. But there is a divine providence and a guiding care. Joseph sees that the guiding hand, in Genesis 50 he can see it. He can see that the guiding hand of God had been involved the whole time. He only now has the ability to look back and recognize that. He doesn't excuse the bad that happened to him, but he puts it in proper perspective, recognizing the providence of God in the whole situation. He realizes that the events which placed him where he ended up were for a purpose bigger than himself. In fact, he calls it to preserve life for many people. But he can only see it on the back end. Go with me to Genesis 45. Genesis 45. And I want to read beginning in verse 5. Genesis 45, verse 5. Or verse 4, actually. And they came near, and he said, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now therefore, be not grieved, nor angry with yourselves. Now I want you to imagine the faces of those he is addressing. And when he says, I am Joseph, your brother, can you imagine the open mouth stare? Don't be angry with yourselves that you sold me here. And why is that? For God did send me before you to preserve life. For God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years has the famine in the land been, and there are 5 more years in which there shall neither be plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. To preserve life in famine. Now this brings us to a couple of points extending beyond the historical narrative. And many of you know, I talk about it often in Amos 8:11. There's this verse about there's a famine coming. Not a famine of bread and water, like you would suppose a famine. But a famine of hearing the words of God. Different kind of famine, but a real famine nonetheless. So what will sustain life during this famine? Just as bread sustains life in a famine of that sort, what will sustain famine in a famine of hearing the word of the Lord? Hearing the word of the Lord. Hearing will bring life. We talked about it last week in the class based on Genesis chapter 37 and the teaching, sticks and bones. The first thing that happens in that particular passage, which also deals with the end times and the gathering together of the children of Israel, is that there is a famine, but the word of the Lord is what ultimately brings these people back. He sees, Joseph sees, that all of this was to bring life. And I want to go through a couple of verses from the Torah that I think should be associated with this idea. Go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Verse 1. Now therefore, listen, O Israel, to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to do them, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers gives you. You shall not add to the word which I command you, neither shall you diminish from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God which I command you. The point that I want to bring out is that listening brings life. We're talking about a famine, not of bread and water, but a famine of hearing the words of Jehovah. Deuteronomy chapter 4, it says very clearly that if you hearken to these, you'll live. To associate listening to the word of Jehovah with life is the point that this is really driving home. Look at chapter 6 of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 6, and we're looking for life associated with hearing. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 24. And Jehovah commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear Jehovah our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive. Right? This is the same phrase in Hebrew where Joseph tells his brothers to preserve you alive. As it is this day, and it will be accounted righteousness in us if we take care to do all these commandments before Jehovah our God as he commanded us. And go with me to Leviticus 18. Leviticus 18. Verse 1, and Jehovah spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am Jehovah your God. After the doings of the land of Egypt in which you dwelt, shall you not do. And after the doings of the land of Canaan into which I bring you, you shall not do. Neither shall you walk in their practices. You shall do my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them. I am Jehovah your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man do, he shall live in them. I am Jehovah. This phrase at the end of this is not to do as they did in Egypt, not to do as they do in the land of Canaan, but do the statutes and judgments, which if a man does them, he'll live. It's interesting that it says Ha'adam, the man. It's more general than one might expect. It's not specific. Now, some might say, well, it's addressed to Israel. But we have passages like in Ecclesiastes, the duty, the whole duty of man is to keep the commandments. As they apply to individuals, right? Some don't apply to me. I'm not a priest. I'm not this. I'm not that. But who could say that the world isn't responsible? You shall not murder. You shall not steal. You shall not commit adultery. Trip a blind person. I mean, these are, you shall honor your father and your mother. I would take it further. Keep the Sabbath. I mean, there are universal aspects. And beside that, the children of Israel to be a light to the nations, to teach the nations of the world what? They're given the Torah. They are called a priest. And that priest's job is to teach the nations of the world to keep the Torah. But this phrase in Leviticus 18, if a man does them, he shall live, appears in a couple of other places. Let's go to Ezekiel. I want to go to Ezekiel chapter 18. Ezekiel 18. And just look with me at verse 5. If a man be just and do that which is lawful and right, has not eaten upon the mountains nor lifted his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, nor defiled his neighbor's wife, nor come near to a menstruous woman, nor does not oppress any, but restores to the debtor his pledge, commits no robbery, gives his bread to the hungry, covers the naked with a garment, does not give out money on interest, nor accept any increase, withdraws his hand from iniquity, executes true judgment between man and man, walks in my statutes and keeps my judgment, to deal truly, he is just, he shall surely live, says Adonai Jehovah. So he gives a series of, if a person does these things, life is a result. Now look down at, let's see. Look at verse 19. When the son has done that which is lawful and right, has kept all my statutes and done them, he shall surely live. Life is associated with doing the commandments. Now look at Ezekiel 20. I want to pick this phrase up in a couple more passages. Chapter 20 of Ezekiel, verse 11. And I gave them my statutes and made my judgments known to them, which if a man do, he may live in them. It's the same as Leviticus 18. Look down at verse 13. They did not follow my statutes. They rejected my judgments, which if a man do, he'll live in them. And then look at verse 21. They did not, again, follow my statutes, nor did they keep my judgments to do them, which if a man do, he may live in them. Look with me to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 9. And looking in Ezra and couldn't figure out why it didn't have enough verses in Ezra and Nehemiah 9. Nehemiah 9, verse 29. And you did forewarn them, and they might, that you might bring them back to your Torah. Yet they acted presumptuously and hearken not to your commandments, but sinned against your judgments, which if a man do, he shall live by them. And they turned a stubborn shoulder, hardened their neck, and would not hear. Yet many years did you bear with them, and you forewarned them by your spirit in your prophets, yet they would not give ear. Therefore, you did give them into the hand of the people of the land. He goes on and it describes the situation brought about because the people were not obedient, because the people wouldn't listen. And so you have contrasted here, God bringing about to fulfill what he has promised and the people kicking and screaming all the way. When we read in Ezekiel 20, we read over and over, they did not do what they were supposed to do. All along, the point has been, if you will do these things, you will live. The message in our day needs to be similar to what the message is consistently presented throughout Scripture. That there is a famine, and that the only way to get life is through these very words that have the power to bring life. Ezekiel 37 makes it clear that they have the power, the word of the Lord has the power to raise the dead, to restore and to preserve life, especially in times of famine. The commandments, the doing of the commandments, brings life. Now, I've taught on this many, many years now about those four verbs that occur in Deuteronomy consistently in order. Listen, learn, guard, and do. It's not enough just to listen. We have to listen to the word. We have to actually do it to bring life. In these days of famine, all of us need to know where to go to get life. Remember in the story of Jacob, it says that he knows that there is food in Egypt. And he sends his sons to get that food. There is a searching now for food in famine. I want you to go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. And I want to just read the first few verses. Deuteronomy 8:1. All the commandments which I command you this day shall you observe to do that you may live. Notice the association, do and live. And multiply and go in and possess the land which Jehovah swore to your fathers. And you shall remember all the way which Jehovah your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to prove to you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or no. And he humbled you and suffered you to hunger and fed you with manna which you knew not, neither you nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread only, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of Jehovah does man live. What brings life in famine is bread. What brings life in a spiritual famine is also bread. But the bread that we're talking about, that which sustains life, is the bread, the Word, the words of the living God. God is guiding behind the scenes, if you will. The days can be few and bad, but God has promised to bring about His plan and His purposes. It will happen. We must know where to go to get food, and that is here. God is guiding behind the scenes to bring about food for famine, and thereby Jehovah is preserving providentially life. Vayihi, and he lived. Shabbat Shalom.